SBS, a world of difference. You're with NITV Radio, on mobile, online and on radio.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land NITV Radio broadcasts from, the Cammeraygal people and their elders past and present. We also acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes and clans we broadcast to. From the mountains to the plains, from the desert to the sea, from fresh water to salt water.
Yama, you're listening to NITV Radio. In today's program, Carolyn Briggs, elder and traditional owner, shares about projections of a current future, a collaboration in storytelling in this year's Melbourne Fringe Festival. Also, a conversation with Alexander Ibarra, educator and co-founder of IndigiBee. And we take a look at regenerative agriculture, the efforts that are being made in Western Australia harnessing Indigenous knowledges to reshape farming practices. That and more on NITV Radio.
Australia Day 1972 saw the first Aboriginal embassy erected outside Parliament.
The native title legislation must be amended.
And they've walked this land so many times before anybody came.
I am sorry.
In today's headlines, Western Australia police say Optus did not contact them about customers' inability to reach emergency services. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has arrived in New York for meeting of the United Nations General Assembly, where Australia expected to recognise a Palestinian state. And riot police and protesters have clashed outside of Presidential Palace in Manila during a major anti-corruption rally in the Philippines. That and more coming up in the news. Western Australia police say Optus did not contact them about customers' inability to reach emergency services for almost 24 hours and did not brief them about the scale and impact of an outage before issuing public press release. WA police say Optus first told them on Thursday night that 26 people had tried to call the police and failed. Detective Superintendent Simone van der Sluis says it took the telco until Friday to tell the state's police that a further 149 calls had not made it through the 000 phone service to reach them in an outage between Wednesday and Thursday.
Sadly, throughout the course of checking on those 149 West Australians, it was identified that a second person attempting to contact 000 during that outage has died.
Both fatalities linked to the Optus outage in Western Australia will be investigated by the state's coroner. The death of a third person in South Australia has also been linked to the Optus outage. Optus CEO has apologised and the company is conducting its own investigation along with the federal and state governments. The Optus 000 outage has spread to another state, with the telco revealing that at least two customers in New South Wales were unable to reach emergency services. The outage has been linked to four deaths so far, with several investigations underway, including by the Australian Communications and Media Authority. Liberal spokesperson for small business, Tim Wilson, told Channel 9 he believes accountability should rest with Optus CEO, Stephen Roux.
I can't see how he's going to survive based on the public pressure and when you've got four people who have died because of it. Exactly as Thomas said, it's disgraceful and should never have happened, but how the ball can stand by and not think there should be accountability is beyond me.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has arrived in New York for a meeting of the United Nations General Assembly, where Australia is expected to recognise a Palestinian state. Mr. Albanese is also under pressure to secure a face-to-face meeting with US President Donald Trump after a meeting on the sidelines of the G7 fell through in June. He says the summit also presents an important opportunity to push for climate action after Australia announced its 2035 emissions target this week.
Well, I'm very proud to be representing Australia at the United Nations this week. This is the first time I've been here as Prime Minister. It's an opportunity to advance Australia's economic, national security, and of course our related environmental interests as well, given that climate change will be front and centre of the United Nations General Assembly this week.
As part of this international trip, the Prime Minister will also visit the UK and the United Arab Emirates. Major European airports, including Brussels, Berlin and London's Heathrow, have been hit by a cyber attack on check-in systems that caused cancellations and long delays for thousands of passengers. The problems were centred on Muse software made by Collins Aerospace, which provides systems at 170 airports globally. Collins Aerospace parent company, RTX, said the impact of the attack was limited to electronic customer check-in and baggage drop and can be mitigated with manual check-in operations. Paul Charles, aviation and travel expert, said the incident was uncommon and deeply worrying.
This is a very clever cyber attack indeed, because it's affected a number of airlines and airports at the same time, not just one airport or one airline, but they've got into the core system that enables airlines to effectively check in many of their passengers at different desks at different airports around Europe. This is highly significant.
At Heathrow, Berlin and Brussels, 29 flight departures and arrivals had been cancelled as of midday on Saturday. Riot police and protesters have clashed outside the presidential palace in Manila during a major anti-corruption rally in the Philippines. At least 17 people were arrested after demonstrators set fire to a barricade and threw rocks at police, who used a water cannon to quell the unrest. Around 50,000 people turned out to the protest, furious over alleged kickbacks to politicians from flood control projects in areas devastated by deadly storms. Flood victim turned activist Althea Trinidad says inequality is rife.
I feel bad that we wallow in poverty, we lose our homes, our lives and our future, while they rake in a big fortune from our taxes that pay for luxury cars, foreign trips and bigger corporate transactions. We want to shift to a system where people will no longer be abused.
Singaporean football legend Fandi Ahmad is calling for Australian teams to return to the top-flight Singaporean league. Fandi Ahmad was greeted by fans at Perth Airport as he arrived in Australia on Sunday. The 63-year-old was the first Singaporean to play in Europe, sharing the pitch with the likes of Diego Maradona and Johan Cruyff. It's been more than 30 years since Australian clubs played in Singapore's league, but in an interview with SBS, Ahmed says it would help grow local talent.
The league will be better, but we need to win the hearts of the fans, because we are a very small country. We have 8 or 9 teams now, and we have all the other clubs coming in. We invite others to come to make the league. I believe to help the national team to be stronger, we must have a strong league.
In 1994, the Perth Kangaroos won the Singaporean league unbeaten, but folded immediately after due to cost pressures. And more in sport, Australian Nicola Asalagas has won gold in the high jump at the World Athletics Championships in Tokyo, with a jump clearing 2 metres in the pouring rain. Queenslander Kai Robinson finished fourth in the men's 5,000-metre final, storming home in the final lap to cross the line in 12 minutes 59.61 seconds. In the 800-metre final, Jess Hull finished eighth, as Kenyan Lillian Adira claimed gold to set the new championship record. And there was disappointment for Australia in the men's 4x100-metre relay final as Caleb Law dropped the baton, with American sprint sensation Noah Lyles leading the US to gold. Penrith has crushed Canterbury Bankstown 46-26, keeping their hopes of a fifth consecutive NRL premiership alive. The Panthers played a near-perfect first half, going to the break nearly 30 points up, scoring 6 tries to 1 and destroying any hope the Bulldogs had of rescuing their season. With the Bulldogs gaining points back in the second half, with Jacob Preston, Bronson Cherry and Jacob Carraz all scoring. Penrith captain Nathan Cleary said the victory has given them confidence for Sunday, the 5th of October, when they'll face the Broncos at Lang Park.
It's sort of been weird the last 2 weeks. I probably felt much more nerves going into the games, just not really knowing how they're going to go. But to the young guys' credit, like the way they started the game today in particular, under a fair bit of pressure. So it's given all of us a lot more confidence that, you know, those guys can perform in big games. And they've proven that throughout the year too, and they just seem to be getting better and better.
And for today in the weather, Monday 22nd of September, Perth is sunny at 27, Broome is sunny at 28, Darwin is seeing possible showers at 34, and Alice Springs is sunny at 20. Thursday Islands are cloudy at 29, Cairns is cloudy at 27, Brisbane is sunny at 29. Sydney is seeing a shower or two at 22, Canberra has showers developing at 17. Albury-Wodonga is cloudy at 11, Melbourne is seeing a shower or two at 14. Hobart has showers at 13, and Adelaide is seeing cloud clearing at 18. And that wraps up the latest in the news, sport and weather. You're listening to NITV Radio.
Your community, your conversation. NITV Radio.
Narit Carolyn Briggs is a Bunwurrung senior elder. I had a conversation with her about the work in Melbourne's Fringe Festival, Projection of a Current Future. It's a public art performance across 4 key sites in Melbourne CBD, combining projection, storytelling and group cycling. Led by Bunwurrung elder Narit Carolyn Briggs, participants follow the journey of the eels of the Williams Creek, stopping at stations where Bunwurrung stories are brought to life through animations, and with a mobile projector on a cargo bike, displays artworks on city buildings, creating a moving reflection on the water with memory and place. Have a listen to this yarn. Yama, you're listening to NITV Radio. Melbourne Fringe Festival is casting projections across the city, and there to give us a little bit of insight into the storytelling is Narwi Carolyn Briggs. Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. I think this is a wonderful opportunity to celebrate this journey, so I call it the Ilk Eel. Ilk. Our language is Ilk. I'm from the Bunwurrung language group. I also have my connection with Wemba Wemba and Turaway, Tasmania.
Who's your mob? Where are you from? What do you do?
I'm from Melbourne. What they call it now, Melbourne. They call it Nan, but I call it Birunga, the country of the river. And I'm from the Yellicut Willem of the Bunwurrung language group. And my family connect back to also Wemba Wemba because of my grandmother, and my great grandfather is Tuaway from Manalagena Waitamotiana. So hence the Briggs name.
This work that's going into Fringe is Kamanji Yilanj Barang Gadhaba. What is that?
Pretty well on that. Well, it means tracking. Baring is tracking. So Kamanji Yilanj, knowledge. Kamanji, together we learn and we're tracking, and its knowledge is rising up through this tracking.
With this projection, it's a physical projection and it's on the back of a mobile bike, and you're taking that story to multiple places.
The remembering of the pathway that the eels travelled from what we now know as Williams Creek when it went flowed under the Melbourne University and through the streets, like what you know as Elizabeth Street. So we're following the journey cycle of the eel.
I wanted to know why it was significant to take the audience on this physical journey with you.
The physical journey is because of people can't see this journey. They've scarred our city by covering up the scar, the traditional design of the previous, before settlement. So this is about the disruption to our part, the eel's journey cycle, which was covered up with tar and cement. And I, underneath is the original tracks of the eel. They never get to see these eels journeying through down Williams Creek, which went under the Melbourne University. Think when Melbourne University was developed and impacted on the journey cycle. Then what happened down in, the only understanding is Elizabeth Street, where the flooding occurs. So they haven't done proper engineering, but they've covered up the journey cycle of the eel. So you cannot see the track that the eel followed. And what we've had to do is define it so that people will follow with us that on that journey, what the eel still continues to do today. Because they have a strong sensory process to return, follow the path of their ancestors. So it's about us following that pathways, remembering that movement as an elder to understand and share this with our alliance for the PAXIS, which is a research at RMIT. And because my role is, I work at Monash, but I'm an adjunct professor at RMIT, so I'm part-time in working with our present-day future, who are, they've got their doctorates. So I'm very fortunate to be able to work with these young people who have brought it to the Fringe Festival to follow the eel's journey beneath our feet, and the country is rising up. So I'm a adjunct professor here, meaning I'm part-time. I work with disruption.
So this work is going to be two showings, and it's going to be later on at the night, so you have to really plan to go and do this. When you take audiences around, what do you hope that they leave with?
The work of the team, I think what it is people understanding beneath this city we now know as Melbourne, there was a story before Melbourne. And this is the only way I bring back my ancestors who lived and died on this country, that teaches me the memories, empowering me with the knowledge that I would like people to come on that journey with me, because it's their journey. They live on this country now. They're looking for the stories of country, but they will be present in today's journey by being active participants, by coming on this journey. They will be understanding before it's all hidden away, and we have to write children's books and we have to keep telling stories.
So you talk a little bit about this being a team collaborative work. Can you tell us who is a part of this, what people did, and like really champion their voices since they're not on the call?
I'm working as here with the Alliance for the PAXIS Research and Melbourne Fringe. And I'm very fortunate to be with the team and my granddaughter, Amina Briggs. She's doing her second master's at Melbourne Uni. It's interesting. We come together to collaborate, because these young people that I'm working with in the Alliance, PAXIS, is also about their research, the tools that they use to be able to revision and give people an opportunity about connecting to the country that they now are a part of. It's a methodology, Indigenous knowledges being projected out there in the broader community, and I'm looking to be present in that process. So it's about memory and future markings of country.
When it comes to this story, can you give us a little bit of a taste of some of the things that you're going to be sharing? Are you telling at any one of these buildings that you're projecting on?
The team are projecting on the buildings to demonstrate this was the original path. People need to see visuals, don't they? So it's about the river, it's about the creeks, it's about memories, it's about chaos, but it's also about hope. And I'm encouraging other Indigenous peoples to create these same stories on their own country, because it is the journey of the Birrarung, the River of Mist, and known as the Yarra, but the Wairneet that runs into Nerm, which is known as Port Phillip Bay. It's about the story of our amazing eels that still survive in this millennia that we know is pretty disrupted at the present time because of what's globally being impacted on us. So it is about the journey of our eels. They have no real identity. They've only got their understanding that they're the eel. That decision of becoming the male and female is something towards the end of their life cycle. They're non-binary at the beginning of their journey cycle. So the identity of who they are is right towards the end of their life cycle. So this was something we've had to investigate, interrogate, to understand, is it a natural phenomenon for male or female? But then we had, and when we explored it, they had no sexual identity. It was like a night, that non-binary world. So we did the fish eel trap in all the colours of our rainbow, so that children see that not everything is as written, the law of male, female. It's about other. It's about diversity. It's about a uniqueness that we can learn from our environment. I hope this gives us some better indication of what we're taking. This more than just a journey. It's a story of connecting more people or bring different stories to our landscape. So it also tells us of the seasons, understanding the six seasons that are conducted in Indigenous knowledges. This season now is bereath. It's the journey of it's early spring after its long sleep of Naiwin Balapo, which was the long resting time for nature to reclaim itself and have that deep sleep. And now it's spring has come. And this is about also the broader, the enlightenment of our new settlers on our country, that nature teaches us everything and how we connect to that, our ecosystem. It's, and people walk around this city not knowing that there's many stories beneath their feet, because it's been covered, it's been erased from the memory cycle of a new settler colony. It's only 230 years old. I made the mistake when I first wrote, and then I had to dig deeper to understand that they don't have an identity. We were trying to track who was the female and who was the male, but we didn't look at the other. It was an elk. It was just an eel. But it had many changes, and it went through those changes, just like people do today. Feeling safe that you're sharing this, and knowing that the colonial construct was what I didn't realise till later on as I did this more research. They called it the Williams Creek or Warranee. I'm bringing language back into these places. So there's four chapters of this process. There are four chapters: the river, memory, chaos and hope, that we hope to get out of this. So that people, when they think consciously walking on country, they're remembering the life cycle, what goes on beneath the tar and cement and the buildings that block their pathways, and how they navigate and remember. So that's why it's about Kamagi, Yalenge, Baring, Gadabar. So it is about improving the knowledge base for our younger generation to pick up and be strong with it, because that's what the hope is. With all the chaos, it's about strengthening the memories of our old people, our ancestors, but it's understanding the life cycle of the river, which is our lifeblood of Mother Earth, Pavanaka, the Wurrungi Bik, the law that conducts our safe passage as we travel through these cycles of life. Because how do we invest back to our younger people? How do we invest back to the people that now inhabit our country? How do we conduct them to care about country? Because it's about caring for themselves and understanding what the laws are of country. We can't do this alone. It takes all of us. I do it in a Western narrative. I'm doing it bringing back language. I'm doing it back with disruption in architecture. I'm doing it with young alliances. I'm doing it through mediums like animation. And I brought it back through food, understanding our food cycles, understanding our season. But it's been a life journey, and I haven't done it alone. Many Indigenous people have invested in me.
With this work that's coming up on the 4th and the 11th, where can people go to find more information for finding out times, tickets? Do they need to reserve a spot? Do they need to let you know who's going to show up?
It's Melbourne Fringe Festival. If they look that up on the internet, I think there's flash sales happening now. You know, it's an investment back, and it's called the Kamagi Yalenge Baring Gadabar Projections of a Current Future.
Thank you so much for jumping on, telling us about this work, and really just sitting here and having a yarn with me today.
Oh, thank you for your listening, darling. So, like we said, it's not about the listening, it's about the deep listening and understand how we connect and celebrate the many nations that live on our country today and still are here.
That was Ngawi Carolyn Briggs talking about her site-specific tour, part of this year's Melbourne Fringe Festival, Kamagi Yalenge Baring Gadabar, Projections of a Current Future. To find more information or RSVP, you can find that at the Melbourne Fringe Festival website. I'm Nairi Pakai. You're listening to NITV Radio.
Conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
NITV Radio producer Sharka Pekova talks with Alexander Ibarra, an educator and co-founder of Indigibe, an Indigenous Australian-owned native bee conservation service. Alex works with Indigibe to rescue and relocate native stingless bee colonies, provide education on those native bees and Indigenous knowledge systems. Have a listen to their chat.
My name is Alex Ibarra, and I'm a Kuma Bidjara man from Queensland, and I'm down here as part of the NICEP Day, Community Day, and looking at STEM and First Nations STEM in action. Yeah, so from Indigibe. So at Indigibe, we are looking at pollinator conservation, also food security, and how that looks across the Australian landscape.
Okay, so let's break that down.
So pollination conservation sort of looks at contextualised pollination of an area and what pollinators are there, whether they be wasps, bees or flies. We have a look and an assessment of that. We may involve bee rescue, so it might be a bee or a beehive that's at risk that we can then remove from that area, conserve, help it to be relocated and then put into a new environment, or relocated back into its original environment. We don't like to move bees off country, and we also like to put bees back on country where they come from, so try and stick to the community law there.
Mm-hmm. And so what would be the risks they are facing?
The main risk of bees is human, is mainly your human risk in climate change. So mainly it's about the development, so development of areas, the habitat loss, and then a lack of education and understanding in the area. So current industry practices is also leading to problematic outcomes for the bees as well. So it's about looking at how can we take First Nations knowledge and understanding and ways of and being and doing, and then use that through a non-Indigenous methodology even, where we can integrate the best parts of all of the different worlds and then get a better outcome for pollination, for our next generations for pollination, for food security, farms in general. I mean, we have new pests and things that are being introduced into Australia with varroa mite. So looking at what native and endemic species that we can work with to food security, biodiversity.
And so how are bees doing in Australia?
Interesting question. People are only really just started looking at them, totally the last 10 years. So we sort of were created out of an ignorance in the space. We sort of ended up in a industry disruptor role. We didn't really intend to be in that space, but just because of the needs of country and our obligations as First Nations people, we've entered into that area. The bees themselves, well, it's a double-edged sword. It's an interesting one. They're in a good position because there's much more known about them. There's more research going into the areas. Their understanding is increasing. The double-edged sword, though, is unfortunately is that there's a commercialization aspect that comes to it. So when money and greed gets involved, there's always going to be an outcome that is undesirable to everyone. So I think it's the benefits and the downside to both areas of it. And then being understanding that it's more complex than it's not just a straight and cut and dry. We're dealing with introduced species, introduced pests, as well as human behaviour, as well as archaic farming practices that have been in Australia for 200 years that are really hard to break those cycles in a modern sense.
And are they in danger?
It's hard because it's solitary bees, very hard to observe. There is research in that area. So I think that they're not endangered. That we would say that there are bees that are at risk, and then depending on the location. So what we find is that because of the pet trade that comes with the buying and selling of bees as pets, we're finding that there's more poaching and stealing of bees from national parks and council areas. It's a juxtaposition of the two worlds, really. So we want people to be aware and conserve, but with the awareness comes exploitative and extractive practices as well for financial gain. We're trying to find that balance between both. We're not against people making a living out of an industry, but we're against making a living at the cost of environment and country. So there needs to be a symbiotic relationship between the two. And I think once we find that balance, I don't think anyone's found it yet, but once we find that balance, I think that's a way of pushing best practice forward, and we can actually probably have maybe one of the first industries in Australia that doesn't destroy the environment to make the country wealthy.
Yeah. That'd be awesome.
That would be great. At least one example would be nice.
You mentioned three areas. The second one was food security. So how is that connected?
So food security is looking at a whole range. At the moment, the world we live in at this very current climate is so unpredictable. We have lots of unpredictable leaders in different countries. You have lots of unpredictable things happening in the range of geographic locations globally. So now is a really nice time to strike for food security in the Australian interests. Before, no one really cared, no one really knew what native bees or solitary bees did. Now there's a whole bunch of research from Argentina. This researcher came out from Argentina, researchers. They went globally, looked at all farmlands in different areas, and they came back showing that roughly between 50 and 60% of pollination was done by solitary bees and native bees from different countries. Not much was done by honeybees. So when people say, you know, 80% on the shopping shelves is all honeybees, it's actually wrong. It's actually close to like 20%. The rest comes from bats, flying foxes, wasps, flies, and native solitary bees. They're the main pollinators of our food systems in Australia. So if we understand what the main pollinators of our food systems in Australia are, we understand where the directives and honeybees are an introduced species, and they're actually not that significant as part of our pollination system. Yes, they have a significant commercial aspect, but in terms of our natural biodiversity and the natural balances on country, they're an introduced species. They actually cause more damage and harm. So how do we encourage the native and the solitary bees to be able to come in and perform that pollination work on other farming and food systems that helps build resilience in that? Because we are approaching bees and bee rescue and from an angle of not just making money or not just looking after the environment or not just being a social cause. It's about looking at the resilience of our food systems for our children and for our children's children. And what do we need to put in place now to ensure that our great-grandchildren, our great-great-grandchildren don't have to deal with the same issues now or have a solution to some of the issues that we don't have a solution to now. So if we can put things in place, they have a better chance of being able to find those solutions and have a better time of it. So I think that's where we're sort of at the moment. Looking at that food security and how that can benefit our children, and also how that helps balance across the national interests of food generation.
Your community, your conversation. NITV Radio.